What?
Help, folks, I'm drowning.
What did you say, sir?
I said, help, I'm drowning, help.
I can't hear you, sir, I can't hear you.
Just a minute.
Yes?
Help!
Thank you. Get back in the water and we'll be out in a flash.
Welcome to GoomPod. My name is Tyler Adams, and this week I am joined by the actor, comedian, and writer, Chaz Early. Hello, Chaz.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. So, Chaz, you know Chaz Early. No relation to Pam Early of Ghostwatch fame,
I take it. Sadly not.
Oh, okay. So you and I got talking because you're a friend of a couple of previous guests of the show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jeremy Lim and Margaret Caborn Smith.
Very much so.
And I suppose one of the sort of major projects that you were involved with was a one-man show about Bill Hicks.
Yeah, I am. Myself and a fellow called Richard Hurst co-wrote a show about Bill when it was approaching the 10th anniversary of his death.
Okay.
And it was my thought to do some sort of, you know, play, put it on somewhere in London or something like that. And he said, no, this is an Edinburgh show. So we wrote that and ended up doing it for sort of 4 or 5 years. And it went from a kind of, you know, a shipping container venue in Edinburgh in its first year up to playing the Apollo Shaftesbury Avenue. And we went to the Melbourne Comedy Festival, went to America with it. It was pretty well received, considering that fans of Bill Hicks can be quite touchy about how you treat their. Yeah, so we did okay. I think we didn't annoy too many people with it, and it was looking at what Bill would be saying 10 years after his death, when so much was the same as the time that he had passed away.
How did you get on with the smoking?
Yeah, actually fine. Weirdly, I mean, I did smoke on stage. I had smoked as a student. And a kind of like, you know, a teenager, late teens and early 20s. I'm glad I stopped doing it after a while, because I was getting through about six cigarettes a show, and for a kind of a basically a non-smoker, that's not brilliant, and obviously not particularly great for the health or anything. But it was just a question of lighting them and not taking too many drags, you know, just at the occasional point, so you didn't look too much of a charlatan.
So was it being in Edinburgh over the years, is that where you met Jeremy and Mark?
I mean it was a little bit earlier than that as well. I was doing various sort of comedy things around, sort of trying to do sketch stuff around London, and as I say, I'd met Richard directed me in a show, and he was in a group called the Four Horsemen, which Jeremy Lin was involved in with. Uh-huh. Okay. And they did a sort of TV pilot that I was involved in, and Margaret was very much through the Edinburgh connection, and she was doing an absolutely brilliant show called The Congress of Oddities. And obviously she's gone on to great things subsequently. And I've been in a band with Jeremy as well. Jeremy and I were in a band called the Dead Val Kilmers for a while.
The Dead Val Kilmers?
Yeah. That was the result of a dream, a fever dream, probably after a very late night in Edinburgh. Jeremy's a fantastic keyboard player, can play absolutely anything, you know, anything you want at any given moment. So he was a great person to have on board.
Well, he's coming back actually in a few weeks.
Oh, fab.
Him and Paul Litchfield together.
Oh, yeah, Paul. Yeah, good.
Yes.
And of course, like The Trap, they were doing stuff as The Trap in Edinburgh around that time, and with Dan Mersch. And they were a very high point of every Edinburgh.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just looking at, because obviously you've done television as well.
Yeah.
I noticed one of your earliest roles, very dear to my heart, The Murder of Roger Ackroyd.
Ah, yes.
Poirot.
Yes. Still get checks for £13.50 because it's been repeated in Albania or something like that. So, yeah, that was a great experience. But that was a lot of fun to do. And, you know, working with Mr. Suchet, who I'd actually worked with before, weirdly, at Plymouth Theatre Royal.
Okay.
And he was a lovely man, and so was Philip Jackson, who played Jap. And, yeah, we had a jolly old time.
Yeah, good.
That was fun, yeah.
Okay. And so, as I say, you and I got in contact through the Jeremy and Margaret connection.
Uh-huh.
And you are a fan of the Goons.
Very much so.
So how did that come about in terms of, like, most people say it's through the dad or parents.
Yeah.
Is that the case with you?
It is very, very much so. I can't quite remember. So I have here in my sweaty hands my dad's copy of Goon But Not Forgotten.
Yeah.
Which was the EMI album released in Parlophone album released in 1967, which has Six Charlies in Search of an Author on side one and Insurance, the White Man's Burden, which we're going to be talking about on side two. And I can't quite remember if I got into his record collection, put this on, and discovered the Goons first there. I mean, that's where I would have discovered the Goons, definitely first. But I can't remember if I'd already been introduced heavily to Spike by that point, because I did. Dad watched Q and laughed uproariously at it, and I would too, even at a very young age, even when there was some sort of quite adult humour in there.
Yeah.
And obviously, I knew Harry from his various Sunday afternoon programmes and his various variety performances, and I would have known Peter because I would have watched the Pink Panther films.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't know who Bluebottle and Eccles are, and you hear them for the first time, I don't know if there's something that is particularly appealing to kind of 7 or 8 year old or whatever I was when I first heard it. But Dad didn't sort of force this on me. I went and found it and I listened to it and I became slightly obsessed to the point of trying to type out the scripts, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And
yeah.
I wrote to Spike with a Goon show of my own, which he very kindly responded to and was very nice about and all that kind of stuff. So, it was so very, very, you know, definitely very preteen. I found the album and it sort of leapt off from there. And I was fortunate in that we had a very good library system and it had a very good record section and you could find some Goon shows on there. And I think it was also during the era of Pick of the Goons being on Radio 4, whichever channel it was. So you could listen to some repeats at the weekend as well. So I've got plenty of sort of C60 cassettes with a couple of random Goon shows on either side as well, which I would. And of course, at that stage, you really had those 20 or 30 Goon shows at best to listen to, whatever you could find on the records and, you know, whichever one you were lucky enough to pick up on the radio. So I was sort of quite obsessive about those particular shows. In fact, even with the show we're going to talk about, Insurance, the White Man's Burden, it's only since the Goon world has expanded so much and the Goon Show Compendium CDs have come out that I've heard bits of, you know, the music cues on a lot of the shows. And
yes,
yeah, because on this album there's no Ellington or Geldray.
Well, that's it. The albums, the pre BBC.
Yeah,
albums were, yeah,
absolutely,
the music was filleted and removed, and but you know, that's all people could get back in the 60s.
That's it, and and that was still very much the case, obviously, until the BBC official BBC releases. You know, there were still a lot of shows that seemed to have great huge chunks gouged out of them, even when you did first get experience of them. And I'm pretty sure some of the replays on Radio 4 would have had a lot of, Ellington and Geldray would have been there, but I think there would have been a lot of sort of things clipped out, the questions of taste and things like that. So,
yes,
he says, using a euphemism, but so very early on, really, I was obsessed then it kind of slightly probably died off a little bit in my 20s and 30s. And obviously since you've been able to get hold of so many Goon shows, it's become a real obsession again for me.
Similar to me, because you're a couple of years older than me, but we're more or less the same age.
How dare you? Yes.
And yeah, I was obsessed up until my 20s, and then that died off. Mm-hmm. And then I've come back to it really in the last 4 or 5 years, and hence this podcast.
Absolutely.
And I always ask guests this question. Were you one of these that would skip, fast forward Ray and Max, or did you listen to it studiously?
Weirdly, I never used to. So when I first got them, I would always listen to it. And actually, in a lot of the shows early on, I did quite like a lot of the shows I heard early on. I did quite like the tunes that Geldre was doing. I have to say that now, partly because I've heard them so often, I will skip over. I mean, I'm a big Ellington fan, and I really like the small quartet, you know, the quartet or mm-hmm. quintet format. Particularly towards the end, he was playing quite a lot of, you know, rhythm and blues, and what would have been, I suppose, a jazzy take on rock and roll. And I quite enjoy that. And that was, again, that's my dad's era's music. Geldre, I find a little bit more, it's a bit more variety, but particularly if there's a tune that I don't know, if it's a song that I don't really have much knowledge of, I will listen, and, you know, I'll go, oh, haven't heard that one before, that's good. So there are things like 1-2 Button My Shoe, which I'd never heard before. I heard Geldre do it. And occasionally he'll do something that, like on Six Charlies, he does When the Red, Red Robin Comes Bob, Bob Bombing Along. And that's, you know, his arrangement of that is quite jolly. But I have to say, in the main, I listen to them. I quite often listen to them in my car. I drive a lot between Devon and London, and I will generally skip over, mainly because I'm just looking forward to getting to the next bit of the actual Goons, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But no, I mean, they're a very important part. I do, you know, I know there's a sort of, I'm sure there are people who are sort of listening in now and going, oh no, you've got to listen to the whole thing. And, you know, I'm familiar with all of them, and I do appreciate their contribution, but I must admit now I do tend to skip over them a little bit.
I listen to them more. I mean, I used to skip them often, but, like, for example, the song that Ray performs in this show today, I reckon it's Love, which he wrote himself, and it's really catchy, actually.
Whenever I walk into a store to buy a thing or two, I never check the bill, 'cause I haven't got a clue. When I count your kisses and add them to my size, I reckon it's love, love, love. I reckon it's love, love, love. I reckon it's love that's shining in your eyes. I don't know how long a piece of string is, or how many waves upon the sea.
It is, and I do, particularly when they've written, I mean, I don't think Max actually wrote any of his contributions, but he does some songs written by Harry Edgington. Fascinating Thing is one of them. I can't remember which show it's in, but I find that interesting because obviously that's Spike's old wartime friend, and I find that really interesting. So, and as I say, again, reading the compendiums, reading the notes in the collection, the CD collections, it's there's often some context which makes you really want to sort of go and rediscover the songs. So, yeah, I do find that interesting.
Yeah, Harry Edgington, of course, who inspired Ying Tong.
Ying Tong, yes, indeed, yeah. It's Ying Tong. Yeah, and that's another big thing that really got me into Spike, that sort of developed my love for the Goons, was reading Spike's war memoirs. I did a drama degree, and part of that, one element of that was a practical element, which you had to go and do yourself. So I adapted and recorded Spike's war memoirs for radio.
Oh, right.
Okay. So, yeah, so that was a lot of fun to do. I mean, it wasn't for a broadcast or anything like that. It was just to be used internally in my university drama department, but that was a lot of fun.
Oh, brilliant. Okay.
So
okay.
I got to play Spike, which was nice.
Excellent. I'm gonna throw something at you now.
Sure.
Okay. You've not prepared for this, and so you might want time to think, and maybe we can come back to it at the end of the show. But you may or may not know that I have a bit of a problem with the What Time Is It Eccles sequence that is, it's the
held up
default,
as being yes.
Yeah, it's the default example that documentaries and whatnot will use to illustrate Goon humour. And although it's a very clever, funny sequence, it gets overused, in my opinion.
I agree.
And I know that there are people who are calling for my head. for such heresy. But is there a sequence from any Goon show doesn't have to be between Eccles and Blue Bottle, just any sort of self-contained sequence that you would put up as a better exemplar of the Goons.
There's a great one. In fact, the whole of the section with Neddy and Eccles on the beach in Insurance the White Man's Burden, which we'll come on to, I'm sure.
Oh, yes.
I think that's an excellent section. I mean, I really like Eccles' standalone sections as well. I mean, I like him in Blue Bottle, but Eccles is by far my favourite character. And his standalone sections when Spike's on form are just so, they so delight me. And I think that's a really strong contender. There's a section in Six Charlies as well where Harry has to go up to the fourth floor, room 3, to meet Crun, who has just sent him up there. And Crun's got there by skipping a couple of pages in the book. And again, that's another a really clever use of the medium, I think.
What is it, sir?
I'd like to pawn myself.
Who sent you up here?
You did.
Then you've come to the right man. Get into this lift. Going down. Page 18. 17, page 16, in the middle. Oh, 15, chapter 1. Crun's pawn shop. Seagun enters and pawns himself. Well, it's a very small part for me, this. Satisfied men, you naughty.
We're back where we started. What do you send me up to the fourth floor for?
To get me.
Get you? Wait a minute. How did you get up there before me?
I skipped a couple of pages.
I've got a good mind to tell the author.
No, don't do that. He might have me killed off in a later chapter. Don't.
Now look, Mr. Crun, how much money will you give me on me?
Well, first I must scrutinize you with an intense scrute.
Before we get started talking about Insurance, the White Man's Burden, I just wanted, if you can just indulge me for a moment, Chaz.
Of course.
Last week on the show, I played host to Chris Smith, and Chris was one of the leading lights of the Goon Show Preservation Society. And he came on to talk about that institution and the history of it, basically. And the show was very, very well received, and people really, really enjoyed that episode, which is great. And I just wanted to say, because during the course of the conversation, Chris mentioned a very early meeting in a pub with Spike and members of the GSPS.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that it was actually, there was a journalist there covering this meeting and wrote an article for Punch magazine about the evening.
Mm.
Okay. And friend of the show and former guest, John Williams, he managed to find this Punch article.
Oh, fantastic.
And he sent it to me. And I'm not going to read it all because it is quite lengthy, but I just wanted to read out a few extracts, if that's okay, because it's quite interesting.
Of course.
It's interesting in the sense that, because it's from September 79. Okay. And as you will hear, it's amazing how people just didn't care about this stuff back then, seemingly. And you'll see what I mean in a minute. Okay. So the writer is Jonathan Sale, and the article is called "The Men in the Goons," which is terrible, terrible.
Yeah.
But it begins, in 30 years' time, will bands of devotees gather to listen to dusty recordings of the men from the ministry? Will listeners, as yet unscheduled, bandy catchphrases from the Navy Lark? Will we look back to the 70s as the golden age of Some Mothers Do Have 'Em, Happy Ever After, and Robin's Nest? maybe Some Mothers Do Have 'Em. The other two, I mean, Happy Ever After was the early Terry and June, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He goes on, any futurologist who knows on which side his slide rule is buttered would give that a low rating on the probability scale. But any observer of the upstairs room of the Green Coat Boy Westminster on the second Tuesday of the month would notice a gathering of the fans of the Goon Show, a program dead and buried two decades ago. They came from the Greater London area, from Kent, and, in the case of one loyal lad, from Guernsey. There was a security man at Vauxhall Motors and a music writer. There are lads of school age. There was Mike Coveney, the society's chief steamer. He goes on to say, Spike Milligan was walking through the door. It is the Ayatollah descending on a Muslim playgroup. Rod Stewart joining a convoy of mods on a scooter trip to Southend. General Haig at a school cadet forces field day. Milligan began with apologies for his absence over the last 7 years. I've got a nit of a manager, and when your letters arrive, she puts them under the bills for underpants. It may well be true that any member of the cast of Are You Being Served could launch himself into impromptu one-man sketches that had me not only forgetting, but quite unable to move the pen on the notebook. It could be that Larry Grayson is able, by the movement of his eyes alone, to parody, to dreadful effect, a familiar character. I do not doubt that Des O'Connor is perfectly capable of producing anarchic wordplay without having it written down in front of him, with hyphens between the syllables and phonetic pronunciation where necessary. it goes on in this vein. Milligan says that there is no question of a goon revival. Sellers gets £1 million for a film. He's not going to come along to the BBC for 75 quid. And could you speak up, Mr. Sellers? Does one of the audience names an actor now connected with the Q epics? Does such and such have trouble remembering his lines? He has trouble remembering himself. He asked me today who he was. I gave him 3 guesses and he still got it wrong. I wonder who that is. I wonder if that was Bob Todd or even David Lodge.
Yeah. John Bluesall, maybe.
Yeah. Spike was serious about the whale, should be saved, overpopulation, should be stopped, and Michael Bentine. Bentine, it seemed, wore an old Etonian tie and said that he, Milligan, had no talent. I don't believe that for a...
No, nor do I.
The Appreciation Society was duly appreciative of learning of this rift between the stars, and the tapes whirred, the cameras flashed, and the books were offered for autographs. It has taken 30 years for Spike and the Society to get to grips. Will he come again in, say, 20 years' time? That may be difficult, but if all else fails, I'll send the bits. Okay, so... it's just interesting, isn't it? It's like the goons is all but forgotten, really, and it's just a small group of... Mind you, the Beatles suffered from this a bit in the 70s,
absolutely. I mean, there was nothing like... And I'm a massive Beatles fan, and I remember them releasing all the singles again in 1982, starting with Love Me Do, and there was a big thing saying it was 20 years ago today. And I remember thinking, God, 20, God, 20 years, that's a lifetime. And but the not that those singles didn't make some ripples in the charts, but there was nothing like the interest at the time. I suppose because people had lived through it, a lot of the people who'd lived through it were still relatively young. Maybe I don't know. There certainly wasn't the obsession, but that has really exploded. But even there, I don't think with the Beatles you would have got quite the same sort of scathing. Look, I know he was won over, this chap writing there, but it feels like it started from a point of view of, you know, this is ever so daft, and, you know, why are we doing it?
Exactly.
And there must have been there must always have been obsessives about stuff. It just only, I suppose it's only really in the last 20 or 30 years where it's become TV shows and radio and kind of pop culture ephemera. And before that, it would have been train spotters and cars and, you know, who knows what.
This is just off the top of my head now, but do you think Star Wars triggered proper fandom, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I suppose before that, it's hard to really see where the obsessives were. Mm. I mean, Doctor Who maybe, although... True. Even then, I mean, I think there were Doctor Who had a lot of fans amongst children, but you would have been more hard pressed to find large groups of older fans gathering together in the kind of zealous ways that they do now. I mean, I went to Longleat in 82 for the 83, sorry, for the 20 year convention. And it was still very, very largely, it felt to me anyway, like, you know, mums and dads shepherding their kids around as much as anything, as much as the sort of, you know, T-shirt wearing, books to be signed, you know, rare video collecting obsessives that you sort of see more now.
Yeah.
And that's, I'm not That's not a judgment on them. I'm just saying it felt like it was a much more of a, it was still kind of more of a children's thing. But yeah, that's a very good point. I think Star Wars probably was one of those first where, you know, you really had to buy the T-shirt, have the record. In fact, I found a copy. I was going through my dad's records to get Boom But Not Forgotten, and I found a copy of a double album of the Star Wars score, and I think it must have clips of the dialogue in it as well. The John Williams album with a big picture of Darth on the front, or his Darth helmet, and it's got a poster inside and stuff like that. And I was thinking, God, that's probably worth 50 quid now. I have to say, Star Wars obsession is something that, because I was sort of 7 or 8 when Star Wars came out, and I was obsessed with Star Wars, but that was something that kind of really died out with the end of the first three films. I know there's a lot of people of my age and either side of my age who, you know, will still go to the launch of every Star Wars film and camp out outside and, you know, all of those kind of things. So weirdly that was a childhood obsession that sort of didn't continue for me.
I again, yeah. people will be reeling at this, but I've only ever watched the first Star Wars film.
The original. Episode 4. Yeah.
And that was about five years ago.
Wow.
And I didn't think much of it at all. And so I didn't bother.
I think it is one. Yeah, I think it was one of those things that you had to kind of find at the time or in your youth, and then get terribly attached to it. And at the time it was so different. It was like before that, or around that same time, my other obsession, just to give you some sort of context, in terms of I went to the film more than once and bought the book and bought the soundtrack album and the comic book album as well, was Bugsy Malone. So, okay. I mean, yeah. I'll, it, that gives you, and Grease was the next big one as well. So there was really nothing like Star Wars at all at the time. I mean, there had been science fiction films, obviously, and there had been shoot 'em up films and heroes and heroines, but it really, I think, touched a nerve. And if you come to it late, I think sort of it's like people who were told how brilliant Widnail Eye is and then watch it in their kind of 30s or 40s and sort of go, oh, really? I think you have to find it at a certain time in your life, perhaps. But interesting point.
Cool. Okay, so let's get started talking about Insurance, the White Man's Burden.
Yes.
Which is the 21st episode of the 7th series.
Yeah.
Broadcast 28th of February 1957 and written by Spike and Larry Stevens. Hmm. Now, as we both commented pre-recording, there wasn't, because I do like to include historical context and talk about what was going on in the world when these shows went out, and there wasn't a huge amount on that day. there was some notable births. Most significantly, the actor John Turturro. Oh. Do you know John Turturro?
Yes, of course. Yeah, and Do the Right Thing and Miller's Crossing.
A brilliant. I mean, I love the Coen brothers, and he's one of the rep company, I suppose, isn't he?
Yeah. Oh, and most famously, obviously, in The Big Lebowski. Cameo turn in that?
Yes, indeed. And of course, he was Barton Fink.
Yes,
he?
Absolutely.
And he was in one of their best films, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah.
And I'm also very fond of the film Quiz Show. Remember Quiz Show.
I do, with Ralph Fiennes. Mm. Mm. Yeah, he's very good in that.
He played the schlub
character,
the schmuck.
It's very difficult to... I thought that was an excellent performance because it was so difficult for... He was a character who you had sympathy for, but he wasn't a sympathetic character.
No,
if you see what I mean.
He wasn't.
You know, so it made for a much more interesting film, and he was great in that.
Indeed, Cindy Wilson of the B-52s was born.
Wow. And her marvelous beehive.
Yeah, absolutely. sort of going down the scale of fame here, Phil Gould, who was member of Level 42.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Ainsley Harriet, was born.
All the great and the good.
Yes. The day before the show went out, Timothy Spall was born.
Okay.
The day after the show went out, nobody was born. Well, I'm sure somebody was born.
Yeah.
The Cat in the Hat was published. Dr. Zeus.
Good Lord.
And the Everly Brothers recorded Bye Bye Love, which obviously was a hugely significant song.
I mean, it was a good time, wasn't it? 57 was a good time. I mean, what's interesting about insurance is that, as far as I know, and I could be quite wrong about this, this has got one of the Goon Show's only direct references to Elvis in it.
Yes.
In that Wallace sings Wallace the Pelvis, they call him. And put that pelvis back, says Milligan in the background. And of course, that's, you know, Elvis the Pelvis was. So it's a sort of indirect reference to Elvis, although Wallace actually sings See You Later, Alligator, which of course was Bill Haley and the Comets. But it was only really in 56 that he became well known to British audiences. This is such a really exciting time. I mean, things are changing so much in 57, I think. And we just had a new prime minister as well. Harold Macmillan had just come in, and things were starting to turn the way of the younger person a bit, I think. And the Goons might have been a little bit part of that. You know, I really do think that sort of anarchic and, you know, anti-establishment kind of vibe, even though it was done in a very light-hearted way, I think that might have been part of that kind of drive.
Right, steady, girls, steady. This is your old Wallace the Pelvis again with some real hot modern rhythm for you. So let's get hep with my latest recording, See You Later, Alligator. See you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile. See you later, alligator. After a while, crocodile. Can't you run my way now? Don't you know you've got my style?
Stop, you mad fool, Greensleeve! Are you out of your mind?
Put that pelvis back.
Tick! Yeah, and the day after this show was recorded, Buddy Holly and the Crickets recorded That'll Be the Day.
See, I mean, for rock and roll, it really was an absolutely, you know, you're right in the heart of it, aren't you, in early 57.
You mentioned Bill Haley. The night the show was recorded, Insurance, the White Man's Burden, Bill Haley was appearing in Kilburn.
Good Lord.
Yes. he was doing a UK tour. Right at the beginning of the show, Greenslade sings See You Later, Alligator. Well, sings is maybe a bit generous.
Yes.
And I'd like to think that he went home after that recording and sort of buzzing and, you know, walked in and said, Mother, because I imagine he would call his wife Mother. I don't know why. I'd say Mother, and he's developed a northern accent. By the way, you can imagine him saying, like, I sang rock and roll tonight and they called me the Pelvis.
And everybody cheered and applauded.
And everybody cheered, and his wife probably. And I don't know why, I've just got it in my head. I've got this Peggy Mount figure in my head, standing there with her arms crossed, regarding her husband with a basilisk glare.
Oh, and rock and roll you, my boy.
Yes, yeah. And saying, that Goon Show, the devil's work, or something like that.
What's interesting is that, so obviously it's been all the, my cat's just appeared.
Oh, what's your cat called?
Wallace.
Wallace?
Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant.
Well, it's a girl cat, and she's named after Wallace Simpson, actually. But, sorry, if she makes some noise, you'll have to excuse me. Anyway, I'll stop that bit again. Yeah, what's interesting, I think, with that is that obviously, particularly in the fifth series, there'd been an awful lot of, you know, morning Greensladers and, you know, keep sending in your checks and all that. But that kind of the Wallace Greenslade fan club in Wallace's head had sort of disappeared out of the show. And this is sort of back to, you know, this is back to that era, that kind of,
it is.
Come on, Wallace fans, let's hear you screaming. Steady, girls, steady. And so that's a sort of little reference back to his when they first made him really central to the show in the fifth series.
Yeah. Oh, and he was always game for anything.
Oh, yeah, of course.
On the show, wasn't he?
Yeah, very much so.
And around the time that the show went out, so Harry was in the middle of filming Davy, the film Davy.
Yep.
Peter and Michael Bentine are halfway through. It's yes, it's the cathode ray tube show. Mm-hmm. Yeah, can't put my teeth in. And the day before this was recorded, Spike and Peter both appeared on the Eamon Andrews show.
Gosh.
Sadly, a recording does not exist.
Yeah, that is a shame.
And as you say, the show came out on the Goon But Not Forgotten LP, which I think has got a terrible cover.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I sort of, it did make me look at it. I suppose it's very much of its era. I think it was released in 67, but it's got two sort of floating head, if you don't know it, it's got two floating head pictures of Harry and Peter, and then they seem to be sort of half looking at Spike, who's stood in a bath with a raincoat on. And it is a bit weird. You would have thought they would have got a picture of all three of them together. However, it's different. It's certainly not one of the typical ones of them all with their fingers in their ears or lighting up their leeks or whatever. So makes it, oh, actually, the one of them lighting up their leeks is on the back cover. But it's not brilliant, but it's striking. It definitely made me pick it out of my dad's record collection and have a look at it.
Yeah, yeah. As you say, it's the B-side to Six Charlies in Search of an Author.
Which is my all-time favourite.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's because I know you wanted to come on, but that's Sean Gaffney has already
bagged that
one.
Yeah, well, it's quite understandable.
Because that's his favourite.
I just understand. I couldn't work out why that. I don't think it was in his. I don't think it was in your top 20 when you'd had the listeners' top 20 list. And I find that remarkable. I just think it's absolutely. I mean, I think Insurance is a fantastic show, and that's also in my top 10. But I think Six Charlies, maybe it's just because it's the first one I ever listened to. But I think it is absolutely. The pacing, the gags, the timing, the fact it's sort of got a vaguely coherent plot and a punchline, I just think it works so brilliantly. But I think Insurance runs it very, very close. And it's, as I say, it's definitely one of my top 10.
Yeah, from my memory, Six Charlies did get a number of, I mean, there was a huge number of votes that I received. And I know that that was probably in the bottom
bubbling
half
under.
Of the 20s or something like that.
Sure.
And apparently for the LP, Spike chose those two shows. Mm-hmm. So I wonder what his criteria was for that. But both strong shows, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, the title is problematic, isn't it, really? Do you know anything about The White Man's Burden, which is obviously a poem by Rudyard Kipling?
Yes, it was. Did he coin the phrase? That I don't know. But I know it's about... It's the presumption that it is the job... It was the job of the white European man to educate the poor and huddled masses that they discovered in other continents who possibly weren't so light-skinned. I mean, to be fair, that has very little reference to this particular show, but it's a terrible phrase. It's a terrible kind of idea that, you know, we had to go and civilize all of these races whose land we went over and laid claim to and pillaged, etc., etc.
It gives the, it's very much saying that the British Empire was a benevolent entity, not designed to enrich the British, of course, but to improve the lot of its subjects.
Yes, we're doing this for you, dear boy. It reminds me very much of that. Eddie Izzard does that section where I can't remember where he's talking about, but they first land, you know, British settlers first land somewhere, and he says, you know, and the locals, the natives say, this is our land, and we will never. And the British sailor says, have you got a flag? So he just plants his flag in the and says, no, it's ours now. You know, no flag.
Yeah.
It's that kind of attitude, I feel, that it's, I mean, obviously Spike was probably is taking the piss out of it, but it's that's the unfortunate connection.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to ask it. Are you a fan of Kipling?
I've never kippled. Thank you. I do like some of his poetry. I do. Just from an entertainment value, obviously, you don't want to look too deeply into what's going on underneath it. But I'm a massive fan purely because of the film of The Man Who Would Be King.
Yes.
You know, an absolute all time classic. So in one of my top 10 films of all time. So indirectly, yes, I wouldn't seek him out. I wouldn't really want to spend a lot of time. I wouldn't have him in my life that much, but that's not a scathing thing. It's just not my taste. And, you know, the same with The Empire. I know there's, I think it obviously did more bad things than good, but I'm one of those people who feels like there is nuance to everything. And while in general it's a thing that we shouldn't be very proud of, there were certainly things that came out of it that weren't, you know, that had a positive effect. Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I mean, I've never really read much Kipling. I know The Jungle Book. I know his son was killed in the First World War. I know that Kim Philby, because Kim Philby's real name is Harold, but he was nicknamed Kim after the boy spy in that Kipling novel called Kim.
Yeah, Kim, yeah.
And the cakes, of course, because obligatory reference to cakes when you mention Kipling.
I don't know who did the 70s voiceovers, but they were some of the most soothing things you could ever hear on television. The old gentleman who did the voiceover.
You don't know who did those?
No, go on. I knew you'd know this.
I can tell you. The actor James Hayter.
Hayter, okay.
Now, you know when I was reading out that article earlier?
Yes.
About the rather unimpressed gentleman who went to watch the Spike gathering. And he mentioned the cast of IE Being Served. Now, James Hayter was for a short period a member of the cast of IE Being Served.
No. Okay.
He was essentially the Mr. Granger character when Arthur Brough departed. He was Mr. Tebbs.
I think that would have been after my time of watching.
Well, famously, Mr. Tebbs was in for maybe a series, I think. Uh-huh. My friend Gary would be able to tell me about this. Mm-hmm. But he was also, at the same time, he was doing the Kipling ad voiceovers.
Right. Yeah.
And Kipling, the company, did not want to be associated with something as smutty and lewd as A Being Served. So they paid James Hayter. They basically agreed that they would pay him what he would have been paid to appear in A Being Served, not to appear.
Good Lord.
So he, as on top of his normal wage for the Kipling adverts.
Well,
so
I'm sure he's very pleased.
He was delighted.
Yes. Speaking as an occasional actor, getting some paid for doing nothing is one of their main aims in life. So that's pretty good.
Absolutely. Okay, finally we start talking about the episode.
Sorry.
We get Greenslade at the beginning. Then you get Sellers on the old Joanna.
Piano obbligato, yes.
Haunting Sellers theme sounding the death knell of all piano postal tuition courses. We present this week's play entitled, and we quote from the suicide note,
Insurance, the White Man's Burden.
Next week I'm covering the film Hoffman, Sellers' film Hoffman. I don't know if you've seen that.
I haven't, actually.
But Sellers plays the piano, the character that Sellers plays the piano in that rather well. So I gather Sellers could play well, but whenever he played the piano on The Goon Show, it was always slightly off key.
Yeah, and these sort of four chords, basically, and nothing else, you know. It was something that you used to get an awful lot. It feels like it's something you got a lot in shows in the fifth series, but they'd sort of slightly disappeared from the show until then. And then here he is, and I presume it's him playing underneath the Tom the Penguin singing as well.
I would imagine so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we the scene begins with a flanneled fool, which I love.
Good morning, flannel fool.
Visiting the British Zoo. Now, what is the British Zoo? Is it not the London Zoo?
I don't know. I mean, the British Zoo. I don't know. Maybe that's just he just wanted a generic name, but London Zoo. I would have thought. Mm.
And we have William Mate Cobblers as the zookeeper.
Yeah.
What do you think about Mate? Is he a favourite character of yours?
Yeah, I really like him. I mean, he's sort of always very hard done by, and I think it's a great voice. And what's interesting in this is that both he and Jim Spriggs, who comes up in a minute, get as much kind of airtime in this episode as certainly as Bloodnock, probably as Bluebottle as well. Yeah, so it's a real kind of all the major characters get a bit of time in this show, but Mate and Jim Spriggs get as much. And I like Willem, and I think he's really good in this as well. There's a couple of really good lines of his in this. You know, what do you call that one sat at the piano? Well, I calls him a pianist, mate. And he sings as well. Yeah, and names all his own words too. And I this whole piano, the penguin thing. So I noticed that in a couple of earlier shows, I was listening to Mysterious Punch Up the Conker earlier, or a couple of days ago, and I think there's a Let the Penguin Out gag in that, and I can't for the life of me work out how they do the penguin sound effect. I can't believe it. Well, it's obviously in this one, it's not an actual penguin because he's sort of singing, but it's like it's like someone's got a strangulated balloon and are twisting it or something like that.
Yeah,
it's an amazing effect. And you could actually believe it was a penguin if it wasn't singing.
Yeah. He talks about kids taking the boa constrictors home, hanging laundry on them. Which I gather was improvised on the day of recording, because in the script it was lions.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah, kids taking lions home.
Might that have given the seed of the missing boa constrictor?
Well, exactly, yes, because which I think is a brilliant show, and it never gets talked about.
Yeah.
And that comes up in a few shows' time.
And I've got to say, actually, the second half of the seventh series, probably more than anything except the first half of the fifth series, is packed with what I consider to be absolutely brilliant shows. I mean, there's the odd failure, but I just think there's so many good shows from The Flea onwards. You know, they're on a real hot streak here.
There's a little bit of what I would call filler, I suppose. Around the World in 80 Days is a bit.
Yeah.
But you are right. I mean, the Rent Collectors and Wings Over Dagenham.
Absolutely. I really like Shifting Sands. It's not one that's really mentioned. Brilliant. Yeah. Punch Up the Conker. This show, Insurance the White Man's Burden. I really like Ill Met by Goonlight. And of course,
Pliny,
it ends on Pliny the series, and that's just one of the all-time greats. So,
Seagoon, the flanneled fool, is enchanted by the penguins, and there's one called Jim, one called Terence,
and Penny,
which obviously,
Milligan, Milligan,
and as you say, you've got Tom the penguin playing the piano, and Seagoon hits upon another. Ultimately fruitless and very soon forgotten money-making scheme to exploit Tom's talent, which made me think a little bit on, that famous Warner Brothers cartoon about the singing frog?
No.
The tap-dancing singing frog.
No.
I don't know that one.
No, I don't.
And this guy tries to make money off the back of this frog that sings and dances, but the problem is the frog only sings and dances when this guy is on his own. He won't do it in front of an audience.
Right. No, I've not seen that.
It's very good. But so Seagoon decides that he's going to try and, buy the penguin, Tom, and he goes to the curator of birds, which is, as you say, Spriggs. And Spriggs looks up in the penguin log, which is a laboured pun. And Spike ad-libs, it's a lie. I didn't write that one.
Yeah.
Which I'm assuming means Larry wrote that.
I think he would have been quite happy to give, inverted commas, credit to any of the things he didn't like in the script.
Just look in this catalogue.
I don't want a cat, I want a penguin. Look in the penguin log.
It's a lie. I didn't write that one.
Yeah, he was always very scathing about Larry, and I'm sad about that because I feel like, and I know John Morris has said in the past, you know, that when Spike writes with someone, they tend to sort of bring his more ridiculous flights of fancy down to earth a little bit more, and that's generally speaking quite a good thing. And I think Larry's really sort of hard done by because some of the absolute corking classics are absolutely you know, partly by his hand at least.
Spike's always was rewriting his own history.
Mm.
And I think it's in subsequent years that he decided that, no, Larry was just an overpaid typist or whatever.
What's interesting with this as well is that it's sort of like the whole of the first 5 minutes or so, 6 minutes, are setting up this whole, I'm going to get this, you know, I've seen this penguin, I'm going to get him on stage. And then, as you say, it's completely forgotten. And the whole of the rest of the show has a quite tightly constructed and almost in real time play out. You know, it's one plot that sort of goes through almost in real time. So it's just that sort of first odd 5 minutes. I wonder how Spike made the leap from, Spike and Larry made the leap from, there's a piano playing penguin, that's a funny concept, to actually I'm going to try and ensure the British Channel.
Well, yeah, because you think about it, I'm sure that the concept, the idea of a piano playing penguin and Seagoon trying to make money off the back of it would have sustained an entire show.
Yeah, I think it could have done.
But yeah, like you say, because Ned is told that Tom costs £20 and Ned's only got 18 shillings. And then when he mentions the money, the mention of that immediately closes down the entire penguin direction. The show was heading.
Absolutely.
And you get Grip Piper Moriarty
arriving in two whooshes. Yeah.
Yes. And again, they've got a, I say again, because they offer Ned a bottle of water.
Yeah. Which
he samples.
Yeah, that happens shades a lot,
of,
doesn't it?
Shades of immediately thinking of
Treasure in the Lake. Yeah. And there's times when he sort of drinks ink with them as well. There's quite often a thing, you know, they'll give him something to drink. And it's odd, isn't it? It's a sort of recurring motif, even if it's only sort of three or four times. But I do like the fact that he's sort of quite a connoisseur of it, though. Good heavens, this is English Channel 1902. that's a slightly different take than their usual one. He's aware of what he's drinking this time, which is quite a good thing.
And I've grown fonder. I've said this many times. I've grown a lot fonder of Grip Piper Moriarty now, the age that I am now, listening to the shows again.
I really like them. I mean, again, after Eccles, I would say they're actually my favourites. And it's the scheming and also the sort of silly wordplay and, you know, the introductions, and this one is a cracker as well. Count Jim Grip, Labour Exchange Moriarty, Leaper Supreme and All England Crab Champion. I've absolutely no idea what he's doing with the crabs, but I like it's an interesting audial image.
Labour Exchange is such a drab expression, isn't it? It just conjures up
and that didn't
an image.
Spike called Sellers that, didn't he? Star of Stage, Screen and Labour Exchange.
Yes.
Or Divorce Court or something. Yeah. And then they said, one thing we have to protect, that you have to ensure the English Channel, and it's the jokal style of protection.
Mm.
And that's always puzzled me. It's like a joke, I assume, but I couldn't.
Yeah, I don't know.
Couldn't work that out means. Otherwise. Yeah, it's very odd.
I don't know what that means. But obviously they're out to, this is another one of those where they're going to trick Neddy.
Yeah.
So they sell him the English Channel and then sell him insurance in case it catches fire.
Yeah.
And Ned is always on the make himself, but he's always oblivious when he's being built himself.
Yes.
So he decides, he decides he's going to deliberately set the channel on fire and claim £48,000 insurance money. hies himself to Pevensey Bay. Pevensey Bay gets repeated, doesn't it?
Yeah, big part of Spike's wartime memory. Obviously, he was down on that part of the coast during the war. So yeah, that gets a lot of callbacks.
Yeah, yeah, and then we reach the scene that you are extremely fond of with between Eccles and Ned. So do you want to describe this?
So Neddy describes himself as tramping through the foot deep snow on the beach to get down to the water's edge. And then he sees Eccles in a full-length bathing costume and suntan oil. And Spike is so brilliant here because there's lots of little... He sort of goes off, he rambles off into little kind of... He sings, you know, there's a smile on my face, I'm a member of the human race, almost like being in love, and sort of does all these little kind of musical and vocal, and then sort of brings himself back by saying, oh, where was I? Oh, yeah. And yeah. I just think he's really... He's so comfortable being Eccles. He can do these little kind of sort of slightly rambly bits and still bring it back to, you know, to the script and to brilliant moments. And so he tries to convince Neddy it's scorching.
Well, my granddad, he phoned up this morning. He said, out of bed, lad. Out of bed. It's a beautiful day.
Where is he?
He was phoning from Bermuda. And who am I to argue?
Dear grandson Eccles, sit down on this fossilized shooting stick.
Ooh! That's an old gag, but a new stick. Well, thank you, my good man.
Now, let me put you right before you freeze to death. It's summer in Bermuda, but it's winter over here.
You can't hold me, Neddy. Look at the reading on this thermometer.
130 degrees?
Yeah.
This thermometer has a temperature. We must get it to a doctor at once.
And with that remark, folks, the case of the Crown versus Neddy Seagoon was proven. Your turn.
Ahem.
Ahem. Ahem. Where were we? Oh, the thermometer.
Wait a minute.
Yes?
You took the thermometer out of a hot water bottle.
Of course. I always keep it in there. If I didn't, it would drop below zero and we'd freeze to death.
And just the whole section is really interesting interplay, and it's not just Eccles being an idiot. It's sometimes Eccles gets the position of power over Neddy during it, and it's a really, really nice exchange, and I think it's one that I would play to non Goon fans, because there's enough, or people just being introduced to the Goons. Because I think there's enough in it in terms of gags just to sort of make them laugh anyway. And I think Spike does Eccles so brilliantly in this section. And it's probably my favourite part of the thing. And then Neddy fires him from slingshot or whatever it is. And he fires...
Catapult,
thank you. Yeah. Couldn't find the word. And he fires him into the English Channel, where he nearly drowns for the whole of the rest of the show.
Well, yes, but you've missed the clever wordplay.
Yeah.
Eccles reveals that he works at a match factory.
I'm sorry, yes.
You work in a match factory, don't you?
Yeah, I'm a dipper.
You put the heads on?
No, I put the gloves on. They're boxing matches. Thank you, my friends. It's all free.
There's what I would class as a clumsy bit of music here. Okay, this is really anal.
Yeah.
When he mentions matches, Seagoon goes, matches! Like he's just remembered that he needs matches.
Yeah.
And there's a quick musical sting from the orchestra.
Yeah.
But it's the musical sting which normally they use to signify a scene transition or a lapse of time.
Yeah.
And to me it sounds inappropriate.
Well, I better get back to the match factory.
Matches!
I think it should be, when he says matches, it should be da da da.
Yes, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it should be a more sort of shock horror chord.
Well, I better get back to the match factory.
Matches!
But I love that Spike then also sings as Eccles. Dum, 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 dum. After it as well. Possibly for that very reason. Possibly for that reason.
Yeah. Oh, we didn't mention as well, there's a slightly topical reference in the sense that Seagoon asks Eccles if he's the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
And that's another brilliant line as well. Oh, the Chancellor of Exchequer. No, I can understand. I've often been mistaken for the Chancellor. No, I've just often been mistaken.
Yeah. And I wondered what that was about, because I thought, it was obviously, in my head, there's obviously, the Chancellor was obviously in the news
yeah.
for some mess up or something. It didn't seem to be necessarily around the time of the recording anything that the Chancellor had done wrong, but it was a gentleman called Peter Thornycroft.
Okay.
Who'd just become Chancellor, replacing Harold Macmillan, who was...
just become PM.
He was PM. Mm-hmm. So he became Chancellor in January, and then he resigned the next year, along with two junior Treasury ministers, because of increased government expenditure. So I don't really know much about what he'd done at this time that caused him to be ridiculed in a goon show. Okay. I said there was two junior Treasury ministers. Uh-huh. One of them was called Nigel Birch. The other one was someone called Enoch Powell.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not the first time he would be forced to resign in disgrace.
So like you say, yes, so Eccles has been catapulted out to sea and he's permanently drowning.
And also another brilliant thing about Spike playing Eccles is, so all through the rest of the show, we hear him go, "Help!" And he does it so brilliantly, and each one is sort of different, and he's doing it from exactly the sort of right part of the studio that makes you think he is quite far away and in the sea. And it's just so well done. It's so well done. And the kind of interjections, and pretty much everyone in the rest of the cast for the whole of the rest of the show tells him to shut up. shut up, you brown fool. That's another really nice Spike moment there.
I love the fact that very often they'll just ad-lib the word brown.
Yes, I know. I don't know why that to give Brown Milligan the chance to say his new catchphrase, but and that makes, yeah. I think that's what makes Sellers then say, "Shut up, you brown fool." But yeah. It is excellent. It's an excellent little qualifying word.
Brown is another one of those drab words.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
We get Minnie and Henry turn up. They are the lifeguards, and they hear Eccles shouting help, and there's a bit of Min and Hen business.
Yeah.
I love the bit where Eccles actually physically climbs out of the water to shout help.
That's another golden moment in the show. I just think that's excellent. And again, that's another thing you could play to goon fans, to non-goon fans or people just being introduced to the goons. It's again, a really clever use of the medium. It's a great gag in and of itself. It's really well done.
It reminded me, my dad always used to tell a joke about, because my dad was Irish, used to tell a joke about an Irishman who drowned in a vat of whiskey, but he got out three times to go to the toilet. it just reminds me of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
We then get Ray, the Ray number, I Reckon It's Love, which as I said, was very nice. And we return and Seagoon is trying to start a fire and he's got a tinder box. And then you have this rather pointless arrival of Bloodknock.
Yeah.
I think.
It's sort of to crowbar Bloodknock in, but it's also really weird in that he doesn't actually try to rip Neddy off himself. Usually in this case, I'm thinking of things like the Pevensey Bay disaster. You know, Ned's being set up by Grippipe and Moriarty, and then Bloodknock appears and also tries to get his own pound of flesh out of Ned. And in this one, he doesn't. He's almost an acceptable authority figure. Okay, he turns a blind eye at Neddy dropping the Neddy offers him £10,000if he turns a blind eye to him dropping matches into the English Channel. I think the most interesting thing about the Bloodknock section here, and I also love Bloodknock, but he says, "I'm the winner of the Golden Richard," which I'm sure is not a phrase that we want to get to.
Yeah.
We want to look too deeply into, really, but it's just an interesting little drop in there. Another fun introduction in the style of the Moriarty introductions.
Yeah, there was a bit of an underwhelming Blue Bottle bit, I felt.
Yes.
I don't know if you agree.
Yeah.
Blue Bottle's briefly in it. His legs are mistaken for twigs.
Yes. And again, that's about it, isn't it? He doesn't really add to the plot an awful lot in this one, but again, it's a nice little interjection to have him in. Just going back to the Bloodknock one, another great thing about this for me, see, I didn't at the time when I first heard this, but I subsequently lived in Beckenham, which is next to Penge, and he said, "I didn't know you had a deaf ear. I found it in a barbershop in Penge, on the floor of a barbershop in Penge." So that's another thing I wanted to bring up about Spike. Spike grew up in Brockley, or when he moved back to London, he lived in Brockley, and he always mentions Catford, in all of his shows. Yeah, there's Catford always gets a larruping, and I'm from Catford. So I was born in Lewisham Hospital and I grew up in Catford. So that was another connection I felt. And just hearing those little, whenever you hear a little Southeast London area being mentioned on the Goons or on Q, it's another really, I perk up, you know, when I hear those things. So.
Well, yeah, Penge is a very unlovely name, isn't it?
It is. It's
again,
actually
drab.
It's actually not a bad place, but it was a. I'm imagining it was a pretty drab place that matched its name at the time. Yeah. But it's not too bad now. But, sorry, Penge, if there's anybody from Penge listening. But now it is quite nice.
The scene shifts, or the action shifts, to the YMCA Royal Suite in Eastbourne. again, YMCA, drab. Mariotti's playing the violin rather badly. Fritz Kreisler.
Yeah.
I don't really.
I mean, I know of him. I it's one of those things that, again, I didn't hear this was cut out of the LP version that's on the LP. So I didn't hear this little section until years and years later. I think Kreisler is someone that Spike really kind of equates with those terrible sort of scratchy, mournful violin obligatos, which I don't think he's particularly fond of. And I think that's why it gets a bit of stick here.
Segan finds out the channel won't catch fire because it's damp.
Yeah.
So he returns to confront Grip Piper Moriarty, who tell him to wait until summer when the channel will be
a fire trap. Fire, exactly.
A fire trap. Then there's a wireless broadcast of Minnie and Henry rescuing Eccles at sea.
Insurance, The White Man's Burden, Part 3. With Neddy fobbed off, coxswains Crown and Bannister pull Eccles ashore.
Thank you. Oh, thank you, Min and Hen, for pulling me out of the English Channel. Another month out there and I'd have drowned of starvation.
Min, yes? Will you join me in the next line?
Yes, I'll help you, yes.
Yes.
We've never got the boat out to you if we hadn't pumped that 1,000 gallons of oil on the sea to calm it.
Yes.
Yes, Henry. Better set fire to it to get rid of it. I'll
put a match with it. Oh, it's caught fire, Henry!
It's a very nice conceit. It's a very clever way of ending it for him to get his for his policy to mature. What luck, my policy's matured. And it's not, you know, it's not by something that's been done by him, but everything has fitted in so beautifully. And you don't often get this, particularly later period Goon shows, you don't often get that. You know, the ends are tied up. You know, the whole story of Eccles being out in the sea. Min and Hen have had to go and rescue him in their lifeboat, but the only way they could make it calm enough is by pouring all this oil on the sea, and then they set fire to it to get rid of it. It's just everything fits in so beautifully. I do love the construction of this. And Six Charlies is another one. And you have to wonder if that's why Spike picked them. He felt that they were very well contained. I mean, not that this seemed to be a factor in the later choices that he made, but they all seem to have a very well-constructed plot, which is
also, because of the richness of the Eccles scene earlier, we can assume that Spike was in a good mood and enjoying himself.
Yeah, I think so,
And so perhaps he remembered that when he was choosing this.
Yeah, good point.
I think the best joke in the whole show is right at the end when Eccles rather formally thanks Minnie and Henry for rescuing him from drowning. He says something along the lines of, if I'd stayed out there much longer, I'd have died of starvation.
I'd have drowned of starvation.
Drowned of starvation. Yeah. Oh, ruin that.
it just makes it doubly good. Yeah, I just think the whole Eccles thing in that. And Min and Hen as well. I mean, Min and Hen are very central. So I'm not the world's greatest Min and Hen fan. And but in this, they have a very, again, tightly compact little scene that sets them up. And the whole scene of them building the lifeboat is a very funny reveal. And they're central to the plot. But they don't kind of, it's not one of those where it feels like Spike's written a massive long scene to kind of just get rid of some time with Min and Hen sort of rambling at each other. So again, another reason why I really like this is that you're right that Blue Bottle doesn't really get much of a fair shout in this, but otherwise people do, they all, everyone gets a really good little scene that sort of drives the plot along. And then we end, of course, with the very best Goon Show theme tune, Lucky Strike. I'm sorry if you were going to go, if you were going to go and add any more about the show itself, but
oh well, I just wanted to mention that yeah. So Segun's it ends very abruptly. Segun's policy has matured because the channel is on fire. Grippipe tells Moriarty to pack the jam tins.
Yeah, that's a regular phrase around this time, isn't it? I suppose jam must have come in tins at that time, but it's. I love that they keep all their belongings in them.
And then at gunpoint, they scarper, leaving Ned with no money. And Ned crestfallen, mentions the show's title.
Yes.
As Sellers, doing a Cockney voice, tells him that his brandy bottle's at the stage door. And there we go.
Hence the hurrying of feet, which you're doing here.
Lucky Strike. Yeah, I think that's probably my favourite theme tune.
I think
show as well.
I just think it's. I don't know what it was that sort of would have ousted it in the next series because, it's sort of towards. I think it's somewhere in series 8. I think it can only be the producers coming in and wanting to use something different because, I mean, I think it's brilliant anyway, but it does also have the ability to. One of the issues was they needed a tune that they could draw out if they needed to. And there is scope to do sort of, you know, scope for soloists to sort of play in the middle of the tune and at the end of it, if need be. But it's great, isn't it? And it's co-written by Ray Ellington, of course.
And as I've said before as well, it's weird that because it gets introduced to the show halfway through series 6.
Yeah.
So it's not even like the beginning of a new series that it's introduced.
I know. The thought processes that drove those decisions are interesting to me, and you can't seem to find out about them anywhere. And again, that how it sort of then disappeared and how the sort of theme tune seemed to chop and change so much from series 8 onwards. That's another thing. When I hearing that kick in was always pleased me a great deal.
Yes. So overall, a brilliant show.
Yeah.
If I'm being honest, it's not one of my favorites. I enjoy it. It's probably in my, if I had to sort of rank my top 30 shows, it would probably be in the late 20s.
Yeah, I mean, like that. It's definitely in my top 20, possibly in my top 10. And I think part of it has got to be, of course, because it was one of the first two I ever heard. So, and as I say, because it has that tight construction, and it doesn't have, you know, some of the more rambly moments in it that you get in some of the other shows, which are often also great, but I think listening to them as a sort of 7 or 8 year old, that probably made it easier for me to digest. And as I say, both that and Six Charlies are still pretty high on my list of all time classics. Go and revisit them, Jims and Toms. Yes. Go and listen to them now. Fantastic shows.
And so, Chaz, I really do hope that you do return because your knowledge and enthusiasm is clear.
Thank you. I'd love to come
back. If you were to return at some point in the future,
yes,
what would you like to cover? Have you thought about show or a film or something? Or
if it was a show, I think what would be quite interesting would be to look at Ye Bandit of Sherwood Forest and Robin Hood and His Merry Mon.
Oh,
I think the differences between those and how, you see, Robin Hood was another one that I had on vinyl in First Men on the Goon, and that was paired with Foiled by President Fred, which is another brilliant show. And I think Robin Hood is an absolutely corking show. I think it's a brilliant show, and it's a vast improvement on Ye Bandit, which is also in and of itself good. It's got good gags in it and some good performances, but I think this sort of the remake, if you like, is much better. And that might be an interesting...
That is
comparison.
A great idea, but Ye Bandit obviously has Dennis Price.
Yes,
which I'd love. I love a bit of Dennis Price.
Robin Hood has Dennis Price. Ye Bandit has Charlotte Mitchell, doesn't it?
Oh, sorry.
Of course,
you're right. Of course it is. Yeah,
but he's had a bit of a rough end of the stick from, you know, some of the people who've written about the show or whatever have said, "Oh, Dennis Price sounds out of place," and I disagree. I think he's dead right for it. I think he's very funny.
Yeah, I was never a big fan of either Ye Bandit or Robin Hood, if I'm being honest. But subsequently, I suppose they were shows I didn't listen to as much as others. But it would be good for you to come back and compare the two. But I'll wrap up. Is there anything else you want to talk about before I do the formal wrap up?
Not at all. Just that, you know, it's so good that you've got so many people tuning into this, and there's still obviously a massive interest in and love of the Goons. And just one thing that I did want to mention is that my friend, in case she listens to it as well, is that I had a South African colleague at work. She's moved on to other roles now, but in my day job, I had a graphic designer, South African colleague. Hello, Julie, if you're listening. And I happened to mention that one day I was going to the gym. I'm going to the gym. And she said, oh, hello, Jim. And she was a sort of mid-30s South African woman. And I said, my God, how do you know the Goon shows? And she said, oh, we had them all the time when I was growing up. My parents were obsessed with them and I really love them. So it's really nice when you get that kind of, you know, there are people everywhere who have heard them and been affected by them and still love them. And I do love that so much.
Totally. Brilliant. Well, hello, Julie. It's Julie.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Hello, Julie. Okay, well, Chaz, listen, it's been brilliant. Thank you so much.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And until the next time, bye-bye.
All the best.